Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. We have Peter Sims on the show. Peter Sims is a best-selling author, co-founder of the Silicon Guild, and founder of BLKSHP Enterprises, Inc. His latest book is Little Bets, How Breakthrough Ideas Merge from Small Discoveries. Thanks for being on the show, Peter.
It is a pleasure, truly.
And am I right in BLKSHP standing for Black Sheep?
It is.
Yay!
Absolutely.
Maybe you could tell me a little bit about what in the world that is.
Black Sheep started because at Pixar they call people black sheep who challenge the status quo. And it was inspiring to me to think that somebody at Pixar challenging the status quo was a pretty unique kind of individual, a unique sort of idea, this notion of a black sheep. Because, you know, having taken the author's path and the creative path in life, along with people who were friends who were social entrepreneurs or writers or other artists, you know, there's a sense that, hey, you know, taking that path of less traveled by is kind of like being a black sheep, but you can't do it alone. And so we just created kind of some hats and T-shirts that then turned into a formal collective of creative thinkers and doers. And now we have over 2,500 of these folks all around the country and around the world. They range from pianists to executives in large organizations who have a really strong creative side that they want to have nourished. And we are just all about nurturing that creative side, that black sheep of, side of everyone. And we do that through creating community. And then we also do that through taking social action, what we call operations, to support social entrepreneurship.
That's really exciting. How can someone become a black sheep? Is there an application process?
You know, the way it's worked up until now is we have just let it kind of expand organically. And so, you know, we have a Facebook page. We also have, you know, in the works right now, we're going to be taking a bus tour around America late this spring. And we're going to be visiting a whole bunch of different places that typically aren't seen in the traditional media, that typically may not be known for people living on the coast or living in cities where they're thriving. And we're going to be going to Detroit. We're going to be going to Tulsa. We're going to be going to the Mississippi Delta, Alabama. And the whole goal of the trip is to, A, bridge the empathy deficit that exists, I think, right now in America, and to also try to do some storytelling around where people are reinventing themselves and their organizations and maybe even some of their communities in the case of Detroit or Pittsburgh, and to try to share new, find new narratives for what the American dream is today and what it can be. And then also take some social action. So we're going to be we hope funding fellowships, Fuse Corps fellowships in some mayor's offices around the country. And these fellows work with mayors for a year, trained in design thinking to help catalyze across sectors social action. So through that, we'll be touching a lot of people and finding more ways to bring people into Black Sheep through a new website and digital platform. So
that's really amazing. In what ways are you going to be helping with the empathy deficit?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is going to be through storytelling. So, you know, I'll give you an example of what I mean by this. In my own personal case, I grew up in a small town in Northern California. My parents were very well educated. My uncle was a logger. My aunt runs a campground. And, you know, I think just to put myself in Uncle Joe's shoes through the years has been a really valuable exercise to understand America a little bit better. And, you know, for people who have Uncle Joe and Aunt Liz, we all kind of have those folks, you know, we're much better off for it. And I think for those who don't interact with the Uncle Joes and the Aunt Liz's as much, you know, we want to go to places, like I say, Detroit, where there are people like Alan Conyerts, who's working in the middle of the Russell Industrial Center, which used to be inhabited by industrial printing presses and publishers that had been cleared out after globalization, and where Alan, a craftsman of the highest order, has had to reinvent himself and his business, going from redesigning kitchens in Detroit to creating beautiful chairs that he has designed and created and now sells online, and has had to kind of figure out how to be an entrepreneur in a whole new way in this new economy, and now has a small staff. And more than that, he's one of two people who've been at the Russell Industrial Center the longest. If you go into this building and walk through the hallways and hear the artists and the entrepreneurs stirring, it's an uplifting feeling of there being a chance for reinvention and renewal in America. I feel like Detroit can be the womb of reinvention and renewal. So we want to tell those stories to try to have bridges between the worlds.
That is so exciting. And you're bridging lots of different worlds, you know, entrepreneurship, art. You're fundamentally interested in entrepreneurship. Not everyone is, right? So, you know, you have lots of interests, it seems like.
I am at core. I always feel like I'm at core. I think of myself as an entrepreneur, even though I've accidentally been an author. And, you know, it's an honor to be able to write for publications. I always feel of myself more as an entrepreneur, a social entrepreneur.
Is it because you like innovation? You like at a large scale, like you like creative products that make a big impact in a big way. Is that part of it?
That's part of it. I mean, what the Silicon Guild is a company that is looking at the publishing industry and how we can organize the authors and the audience a little bit better to be able to service those needs than the current system. So there's certainly a passion that comes for wanting to see change in an industry in that case. And I think also it's just the feeling that working with a group of people in collaboration, I try to be very, you know, very collaborative in the way I work. It's very rewarding. It's fun, you know, and by the way, you can make a decent living. I've never been motivated by money more than to want to send my kids to good schools. And so, yeah, entrepreneurship has just been a chance to work with people I really enjoy working with every day on interesting problems, following that curiosity and to be able to, you know, to actually affect change. I mean, to be a part of, I always love the Alan Kay quote, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And I feel like entrepreneurship is a vehicle for that.
Oh, I really like that. Oh, well, I want that quote to sink in my head for a second there. You're not really predicting anything if you invent it. You're just, I feel like we can go further with that analogy in some way if I think about it a little bit further. Anyway, well, maybe we'll return to that in our interview. So I was wondering, you know, just randomly just woke up in the middle of the night wondering, what do Apple CEO Steve Jobs, comedian Chris Rock, prize-winning architect Frank Sgeri, and the story developers of Pixar films all have in common? Do you have any idea?
Well, I mean, when it comes to the creative process, I think having studied the creative process for this book that you mentioned, Little Bets, the common element that stands out to me that I didn't know about before was just how experimental, like anyone, Steve Jobs used design as the mindset to drive product development at Apple. And design is inherently experimental and driven by prototypes and driven by, you know, the rapid prototyping process of trying a lot of things in order to identify opportunities, and then once you have, narrow in on those to delve deeper into what will be more of a completed idea. Okay. So we may have started with, I'm just throwing this out there, I've heard this number roughly from around 100 ideas to get to 3, to get to one, right? So, you know, that's sort of the scuttlebutt from the Apple community that I've heard. Mm. Now, Chris Rock, or all comedians for that matter, must take their material to small clubs to try it before it's anywhere near ready for the big show. And so Chris goes to a place right near where he lives in New Jersey, and he will show up unannounced and with scribbled ideas on a piece of paper and try one after the other until he starts to hone in on ideas that could be a joke that could lead to, you know, one piece of a 60-minute act. And he will do that for 6 months to a year before he's got 60 minutes of material. So there's an enormous amount of experimentation, most of which doesn't work. We can debate whether that's failure or not, but that's the process of creating comedy. And Frank Gehry or an architect like that will often work through dozens and dozens of models in order to refine and determine the problems that he's really trying to solve with a piece of architecture. So this realization for me, and through the research that, Scott, you're way more familiar with than I am, is that the reality of creators or inventors is often that they have to try, you know, 95% ideas that don't work for every 5% to become great. Roughly that, you know, Hewlett Packard, they would say 95%, you know, something like 94 small bets to come up with 6 breaks. You know, you would have, you know, at Apple, we said 100 to 3 to 1. 100 ideas to get down to 3 good possibilities to get down to 1 final idea. You know, at The Onion, they keep track of statistics at The Onion. They have to come up with something like, they come up with something like, you know, several hundred, I'm forgetting the exact number, several hundred headlines every week to get to 18 that finally make the cut. So it's like a 3 or 4% success rate. Right. And so here we are schooled to be coming up with the answers all through our lives. And then the reality of creativity in all these different fields is that you have to be using a learn by doing mindset. And we just don't have that. So that was my goal with Little Bets, is to give people, you know, kind of a story driven research based book to help them develop that mindset.
Yeah, no, I really like that aspect. And it really, it's very much related to this idea of taking risks and you're saying what is innovative about what you're saying is you're saying lots of small risks add up because they provide good feedback. So I think there really
isn't risk, right? If you're taking a small bet, the definition of a small bet is that it's an affordable loss. And this is a really important point. You've determined up front what you're willing to lose, whether it's time or money. You know, you've actually done that analytically so that you have nothing to lose. You're just trying something.
So, yeah, I love this. And I think it can apply to lots of areas of life. So what about guys with social anxiety that are terrified of approaching women that they find adorable? Do you think that this applies to them as well? I mean, a small bet would be literally just smiling at the person. Right.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert
in a non-creepy way
in the scientific research on this as you are, but I would suggest that now I'm married, but when I was dating, I was terrible at it at first. I was a late bloomer. I struggled through trying to figure out who I was and what
you?
I was for. And, oh, absolutely. I mean, everybody has to, right?
You're pretty smooth. You're pretty smooth.
No, everybody has to, right? I mean, this is life. This is, so from a dating standpoint for me, you know, I've probably gone out on more dates in San Francisco than anybody I know after business school.
Did you find them online? Did you do like OkCupid or something?
I tried that. I did. I went out with a few people through online. I tried a lot of different things because, you know, I really was trying to figure out what would be the right, who I would be right for, and what the right fit would be. And, and in San Francisco, it's kind of a tricky market. So that's a longer conversation, but.
I bet.
But yeah, it's little bets. It is little bets. And I wasn't thinking about that when I wrote the book, but a lot of people have mentioned it to me as a potential application. But the point is that anything we do that's new, that's developing it, whether it's a new comedy act or a new skill set or a new fluency and comfort in an area that we're not strong in, you know, it's deliberate practice. And so where I hope to see the parallels with the psychology research with Little Betts is where Carol Dweck talks about developing a growth mindset. You know, you can develop a growth mindset by being willing to try things and by being willing to learn from small setbacks. And it gets easier, right? It gets easier for Jerry Seinfeld the more he gets into developing a comedy act, just as it gets easier to go about dating, just as it gets easier to do all these things, if you're willing to just get out there and start. You got to try and you got to work at it. It's not easy for anyone. And that's the myth I'm hoping we can start to break apart.
I really like this. And so what is talent then? What would you say that's just a concept that doesn't exist?
Well, everybody has their talents. Everybody has their various really strong strengths, and everybody has things that their weaknesses are. And I'm not suggesting that there's not an important recognition of the role of talent. Like, for example, Tom Raff, my colleague with the Silicon Guild, has written books called StrengthsFinder books, StrengthsFinder 2.0. And I'm a big believer we all should play to our strengths. I mean, that's pretty empirical, and Tom's really kind of been, you know, leading the way on popularizing that. So we should try to have enough self-awareness to understand our strengths. One of the things I've been struck by in doing my research with different leaders or different people, though, is how many weaknesses they all have. Steve Jobs failed many, many times. Yeah, he could not have predicted many times over what Pixar would become. He had no idea. He just bet on the right people with Ed Catmull and John Lasseter. Howard Schultz, plenty of weaknesses. Wendy Kopp, same thing. But they all understand how to surround themselves with people who complement those weaknesses. So I think all of us have some really superb talents, and we just have to identify those and recognize we don't have to have it all.
We don't?
Nobody does. If you be truthful and honest, people, you know, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, I think.
No, I definitely agree. I tend to be a bit cheeky, Peter Sims, so thanks for just going with me. I'm wondering, one if you could describe one story that you have in your book that my students and I, we found it just absolutely compelling. The story of how Pixar films had such amazing success through their storyboarding process. Could you just briefly talk about that?
Yeah, so Pixar will take about 5 years to make a new film, and when they're beginning a film, the first 2 years are dedicated to understanding the story. Mm. And the the Pixar stories are done literally by taking, you know, small note cards, drawing pictures on them, and putting them on the board. So the story artists come up with these really rough ideas for characters and for potential scenes. Potential storylines, and they put those up, and then they literally act those out in front of their colleagues. And, some of these ideas will make it, but most don't. And so it's this process of constant revision, and the story team is working in an environment where they only use this technique that they call plussing. And plussing is where, they take ideas, they see the ideas as the story artists are presenting them, and as the colleagues reflect on the ideas, they don't use harsh or judgmental language. They say, they use two techniques from improv, using yes and, taking the idea and saying, yes and, what if we did this? Yes and, what if we did? And that's plussing. And they just constantly pluss ideas right through to the end of the film at Pixar. This is the culture. The improvisation is at the core of the culture of Pixar, and the person who makes the decision on the ideas ultimately is the director. And the ideas have to be perfect in the mind of the director before they get green-lighted. And the director, as the story is maturing, and as there's enough characters and storylines, they'll put it into a comic book version of the movie. These are called reels, and they show those versions with very rough dialogue to larger groups, and then they solicit feedback from everyone in the room, including the janitor or people who work in the cafeteria at Pixar, and they say, the director then reads all those comments and decides what to integrate into the next iteration. So literally thousands, millions, really tens of thousands of storyboards, 50, 60, 70,000 storyboards per movie, millions of little bets go into each Pixar film. And the great ideas can come from anyone. And so the culture at Pixar is very strong in the sense that John Lasseter, who's the chief creative officer, doesn't have all the ideas, nor does Ed Catmull, who's the president. And Ed Catmull, who I've come to know personally, will always say, I don't know all the ideas. If you have ideas on writing a book that I can learn from, I really want to learn from those. And that's the curiosity and humility of the Pixar culture that is very unique in the corporate world.
That's so great. And it dovetails nicely with psychological theories such as the Darwinian model of creativity that Dean Simonton has been a big proponent of, in which the creative process mirrors the evolutionary process, in which you have blind variation. You produce lots and lots of variants, ideas, without knowing which ones are necessarily going to be the ones that are the winners. And then you have selective retention, where you choose the most promising ones. But that initial stage has been shown to be very important to the creative process. Are you familiar with Dean Simonton's theory?
Very much so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And he's at Davis, isn't he?
Yep, he sure is.
Yeah, absolutely. He's done some superb research. So
yeah, very consistent. And your blind variation aspect includes lots and lots of small bets
or absolutely.
Little bets. And I think that's a really unique contribution to the field, this idea you have.
Wow. I mean, I'm just synthesizing. It's not original research. It's just really what I hope it can help with is just a translation for people.
Well, I appreciate that modesty, but I think synthesis is, you're still creating something new, right? It's like saying like human consciousness is, it's just the combination of the emergence of different brain regions. But what emerges is freaking original.
Yeah,
so don't be like,
I've thought of that before.
What did you say?
I hadn't thought of that one before.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry. I think of things on the spot that I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. So there's just so many things we can.
Black sheep right there. That's definitely.
You called me a black sheep at one point. Did you ever retract that statement?
Yeah. No, you are.
Am I still? Okay, good.
You're great.
I still count? Okay, good.
100%.
What'd you say?
100%.
Oh, yay! Yeah. Woo!
We got to get you the swag.
Well, my mom always said, Scott, when I was real young, she said, you always dance to the tune of a different drummer. And in that context, I think she was trying to make me feel good for the fact that I literally would dance to a tune of a different drummer while all the other kids were supposed to be reading a book. I'd be like running around with my Superman cape or something. And people like, that's weird. But but I guess as an adult, it's called creativity.
It's being human, right? And it's we need to empower that in young kids. I mean, it all goes back to education. And if we can, in some way, small way, be role models to those coming up and say it's okay to be different and to be unique and not be fit in with some perfectionist ideal, then that's pretty empowering. And, you know, the secret is, I think the real secret is that all those people who are, you know, we all go to high school and we're cool kids or not. I was definitely, you know, an outsider. But, you know, when you get to the point in, you know, where we are in our lives now, all my friends from high school who were the cool kids are actually, they're all black sheep too. You know, they want to be doing, you know, unique creative things in the world as well. And they felt enormous pressure for conformity. So, you know, this is a cult. This is a, I don't know if it's endemic to all cultures, but there's certainly a enormous amount of conformist pressure in modern industrial life, you know.
Well, this is interesting. I want to talk about this because on the one hand, there is a innate drive to belong. And and often we compete with our innate drive for uniqueness. And But clearly there's individual differences. Some people are clearly weighted more to the other. You know, there are people who have a very, very high need for uniqueness and actually don't care as much about belonging. Whereas those who are obsessed with belonging, and those people don't tend to be as creative, I don't think. If you're too much in that direction, because then you're never going to take risks.
Well, and you know, it's difficult for people who feel the pressure to conform because they never get to access that part of them that is creative. So I start with the belief that everybody has an inherent creative side. Everybody, you know, for me, I didn't know, I never was called creative until my 30s. I mean, really, I mean, I got C in my art class and, you know, I never thought of myself as creative. And then I got into design thinking and George Kemble taught me all about design at the D School at Stanford. And all of a sudden, wow, I feel like I'm a totally creative. But now I'm like, you know, that's sort of what I do is creativity. But
sort of.
And so.
It's what you do.
And so. That was all there waiting to be unlocked. And it had to be unlocked through a lot of cultural pressures and, you know, should you be a venture capital investor and should you do the safe things in life? You know, I have a lot of stories to share about that. But it's hard. It's hard because, you know, we're all, you know, in this post-industrial world, we're all taught to be focused on a particular function from a pretty early age. And, you know, there is a very real sense of fear that people can get lost on that, you know, machine that's chugging along. And so there's very real reasons why, you know, conformity from early stages makes sense from a security standpoint. What I'm saying with Black Sheep is like, hey, be the outsider, be different. The only way you can do that is in community with other Black Sheep across disciplines.
Yeah.
Let's empower each other. And then if we can do that, then we can really start, you know, hopefully to ripple into the conformity puzzle.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It really is about finding your clan, so to speak.
Everybody needs one. We all need that.
Right. If everyone tomorrow decided they're going to become Peter Sims Black Sheeps, then it would all conform, technically.
Right. That's right. It would be boring.
It would be the black sheeps would be really boring.
Yeah.
So we need society needs a certain amount to be black sheep, a certain amount to what are the white sheep doing? They're just following the societal script in a way, or you expectations.
Know, to me, you know, like I say, I think most humans have a great black sheep in them. I think that the people I think of as white sheep are people who are cowards, who manipulate humanity and who are evil. You know, just, you can think of people throughout history who fit that mantra and who are just evil.
I want to make clear, you're not talking about the animal because I don't want to offend any white sheep who are listening to this podcast. You were talking about humans as a metaphor. Just want to make that clear. Because yeah. A very large portion of my podcast audience are sheep, the actual sheep, the animal. So I want to just make that clear.
That's good that you mentioned this to me now.
Yeah. I thought I should mention that before this goes any further, before we think you're being racist or anything, or animalist or anything.
Yes. Very good.
So this is interesting. So it's almost like you're saying, like, narcissists are white sheep. It's like it's very interesting. Like you're or manipulative, like dark triad people. You know, you're aware of the dark triad people who are, you know, Machiavellian and narcissistic and psychopathic. What are these people? You're saying that you're saying in a way they're actually white sheep.
God, I'd have to think about that type. I'm not an expert on all these typologies. It's really more an emphasis on the positive, you know. It's an emphasis on, you know, if one time I'll give you an example. My friend and somebody who's been a great peer mentor to me is Richard Tate, who's the founder of Cranium, and I had interviewed him for True North, the first book I did. Accidentally did this book, and it was just a wonderful opportunity that fell into my lap to go out and learn from all these interesting people. And yeah, I met with Richard and Howard Schultz in Seattle the same day. Howard at Starbucks and Richard at Crane, and they're both close friends. And I just felt like, wow, this is my tribe. I'm feeling something I didn't know. You know, this is inside calling to me.
What was it? What was it? What was the commonality between you and them?
Well, I think, at the core of what Richard is all about And which is what I was going to tell you about Black Sheep. You know, so Richard loves Black Sheep and he's been very supportive. He's got a whole t-shirt line that he's developing for us. And he says, you know, it makes me feel like I can be me. I can be human.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me, to be able to hear that from somebody who's given that gift to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it brings emotion. I mean, it's like, there's that humanity that is really hard to find.
Yeah.
But if you're, you know, there's so many people striving every day courageously to get to that and just be themselves and be able to, you know, make a living in this world. I mean, that is a heroic undertaking. You know, that to me is really what we focus on, is the positive with Black Sheep. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about White Sheep, to be honest with you.
No, I understand. It's just so interesting because it's so much in line with humanistic psychology, positive psychology, things that I, you know, personally interested in research, and this idea of self-actualization.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a fascinated student, you know, kind of a layman student of the field of positive psychology, and as it's gotten into the, you know, into neuroscience, and as that's been more validated as a line of research and thinking, and how it's influenced business, how it's influenced government planners, how it's influenced people at the very individual level thinking through how to find meaning in their life without, you know, religion necessarily being the centerpiece. So I think it's a movement, huge movement that is changing the world. And yeah, I'd say, you know, Richard and Howard are humanists, as best I can tell.
Yep.
And so, yeah, that would be a common thread of values. And I think the other thing is that there are different types of entrepreneurs. And I know from working in venture capital, there are certain entrepreneurs who are very pragmatic, who just want to – they could be working in a mattress business, or they could be working in a poster business, or they could be working – they don't really care. They just want to turn into a good business. And I went to business school with a lot of people like that. And then there are entrepreneurs who have to really be passionate about their idea and really create it. And I call these entrepreneurs more artistic entrepreneurs. And I would say Howard and Richard are both those types. And I feel like that's more the camp that I would fall in personally. So I think those are two. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think about, I keep thinking about the white sheep. So what if there's a bunch of white sheep who, if self-actualization is a fundamental human drive of human nature, and you have lots and lots of white sheep who in their hearts really want to express their unique self more, but there's an individual differences variable there, maybe shyness or maybe anxiety, fear, things that are holding them back. I mean, shouldn't we empower them too?
Absolutely. I mean,
so they could be kind of converts, right? I mean, you'll accept white sheep who want to be black sheep, yeah?
I don't – it's hard for me to go around labeling people as white sheep because I just don't think in those terms really.
Everyone has a black sheep inside of them basically.
Yeah, I feel that way. I feel like there are certain people where, you know, it's just like – I mean, like I've been working on an assignment on violent extremism with the White House, and it's been a pretty interesting assignment. It came to through other members of Silicon Guild. And I sort of look at some of these people and I say, it's pure evil. You know, it's just like, that's white sheep to me. But, you know, for people who are just wanting to take their own path and wanting to, you know, start taking the first steps towards it, I think the best thing you can do is hang out with people who are creative. So when I came out of business school, I wanted to do something more entrepreneurial. And it was very hard to get to that. It took years of, you know, some very dark years.
Yeah.
But I hung out with entrepreneurs and with artists. And then it became very natural for me to take that path. It was very validating. And so for those types of people, I hope that Black Sheep in different cities, we can have outposts, for example, in different cities to help people who are kind of wanting to be more creative to kind of bridge more into those circles.
I really like that. I mean, you're starting a movement. Yeah.
you know, it's just, it's very organic. So it's fun. We have a lot of fun and, you know, who knows where it will lead, but we're just setting it up so that it has a strong mission and culture and let it go from there.
It's great. So part of being a black sheep is, would you say play is a central component of that black sheep have?
So we play a lot. And there's a huge sense of humor, I think, to the whole culture. But, you know, we have five values. We sort of said, and Richard Tate helped to create these values. It was like the five C's of curiosity, and collaboration and having conviction for ideas and be willing to chase after those. You're willing to make a contribution, a positive contribution, basic creative values, right? We can just say five C's. And then we said there's only one rule. You have to have spent 5% of your time, 5% rule, 5% of your time towards social good causes.
Nice.
Time, not money.
At least 5%. You can spend more if you want, right?
Yeah, at least. And those are the rules. And, you know, no assholes. So those are basic guidelines. And we're not political. We're social entrepreneurs. We're focused on using creativity to solve problems in new ways. And
okay.
We do these operations. That's how we channel our energies.
Pretty incredible. You also talk about, so we talk about play. You also talk about openness to experience, which you may know is my, that's my favorite.
Yeah.
That's my favorite if I had to pick one.
Yeah. Because it's true that this creativity is just connecting things.
Well, that goes us back to our synthesis conversation we had earlier. But you're like, all I'm doing is integrating. Well, you're also you're connecting.
Yeah, connecting. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's sort of how my mind is wired, right?
To
be, you know, intuitively connecting different, whether it's people or ideas or problems to people to whatever. I mean, that's sort of how I'm wired.
Yeah, and me too. No, I totally understand. And I think that this all, in terms of connecting things, right? So we can connect the idea of little bets. The more little bets you make and you see before you, all you know, the more grist for the mill, so to speak, you have to connect the dots, right?
That's right.
You have absolutely. You can just view everything as just grist for the mill. Yeah.
You know, I personally, I don't necessarily frame it that way personally. I mean, and I, you know, I think it is a great way to frame it. But
yeah, how do you think about it?
I'm just really curious. I mean,
yeah.
I'm a peer learner. So whenever I'm talking with someone, I'm always thinking about, you know, what can I learn? What can I give? You know, here it's just it makes life interesting to be able to do that. And then things start to and then insights pop up later in conversations. I mean, you know, today I was at a company. I was advising them on something that they're wrestling with. It's a really interesting company. It's a really interesting set of problems. And if I think on that whiteboard on the ideas that I shared with them from my view on what they could do, it's spanning many, many experiences and chapters in my life, people, concepts, blah, blah, blah. And the company was really thirsty for this. I mean, just like they needed this. And so, yeah, it just kind of all comes together. But I love the way John Donahoe put it when I interviewed him for True North. He said, just learn a little bit from a lot of people. And, you know, don't think of any one person as a mentor, but everyone can be a mentor, you know?
Yeah, and you do. You talk in your book about the importance of networking with people from different backgrounds. All these things to me just seem like it's all connected to connecting dots, right? You can connect dots through ideas, through people, through to me, it comes down to openness to experience and curiosity. Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, when I see openness to experience, by the way, curiosity is the central aspect. Exploration and curiosity that's what holds openness to experience together. So I'm
you know on that note, I think it's really important that I make this one point, and that is
sure.
By virtue of this strange job that I've had, I've met all these leaders throughout, you know, my work in venture capital and as an author. And I'm always struck by how the best leaders, the best entrepreneurs, whether it's Howard Schultz or Chet Pipkin, who started Belkin, or Wendy Kopp, the best of the best that I think of as the best leaders, or Ed Catmull is one of my favorites of Pixar. They're so curious. And, you know, they don't, there's no ego. They have egos, but they don't present that in front of the interaction that we're having, you know? Like,
I love it.
Howard, also, if I send Howard an email, as I've had a few times on a topic, he will, you know, he's called me up and said, I want to talk with you about this, and he'll go through the details. And, you know, Ed Catmull had to learn how to do book publishing from scratch, and he just, like, literally turned to me, somebody who's, you know, a nobody compared to Ed Catmull. And he said, you know, how do I figure all this out? And I just feel like there's that humility to be able to listen that and ask the right questions and to listen that, you know, you can probably get away with, like, Steve Jobs probably wasn't the best listener. I'm sure he wasn't at all. So, you know, there are a few people who can get away with that. But most people are really shooting themselves in the foot if they aren't taking every opportunity to learn, you know. And having their ego get in the way of insight that could help them do their job and lead their company much better. So it's a philosophical point, but I also feel like there's a whole practical, you know, there's practicality behind it too.
I'm sorry, what do you say? I stopped listening. No, I'm joking. Joke.
Who's the audience here?
What do you mean?
Is this where does this go? Does this
the whole
go
world? On? The whole world.
On through iTunes or through
where you iTunes, Scientific American?
Oh my gosh.
Why?
Well, I know you got a huge following, so I hope that I'm not
You're killing this. No, isn't he killing this? No, you're totally killing this. By the way, you got my joke when I said what do you say, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to make it clear. I was actually listening. I was just waiting for you to stop talking so I could make that joke. I was like,
give me the punchline.
Yeah. I was like, I'm going to promote this up the kazoo. It's good. It's really good. I want to talk to you a little bit about, like, educational implications of all of this, because this is obviously something I'm deeply interested in. You know, you have lots of black sheep in classroom that we label with all sorts of things, ADHD, blah, blah, you know, dyslexia, blah, blah, blah. I imagine a lot of black sheep that are part of you've identified, I bet a lot of them have, you know, struggled through certain things. Life hasn't been easy, right? So, yeah, I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about what we can do to support those folks.
Amen. It all goes back to education, as I said earlier, and I think you're right. I think the people who have taken, the creative, there are so many challenges to the creative path. When I was in the second grade, my teacher gave us all these worksheets to do, long division, multiplication, all this worksheet after worksheet after worksheet. And all I wanted to do was go out and play. You know, I just wanted to be a kid.
Me too.
And so I eventually got kicked out of that class. You know, that was sort of the... It was like this, you know, the first little challenge of my young life was getting kicked out of this class and you know, out of the, a gate class, an advanced class. And then I was, after that, I was like, you know, just a regular kid, which was fine. But I was wondering, like, why was I no longer with that group of people I'd been with for a few years, you know? So it was like, I think there's just, there's a lot of that. I've been really drawn to what I've learned about Montessori and programs like that that encourage young kids to follow their curiosity and to, you know, as best as possible within some guidelines, learn how to be self-learners at a very early age. And I find that I wrote an article about this in the Wall Street Journal called the Montessori Mafia, which is I've gotten probably 1,000 emails about, because every mother and, you know, every wife has sent their, you know, husband this article and who's interested in this type of creativity and education. And so I've learned more about Montessori and you know, again, I'm not a researcher, obviously, but anecdotally, I've not encountered only one or two cases where people say, yeah, Montessori was a detriment to my education because there wasn't structure.
I've heard such good things.
Yeah, you know, and so...
Why the mafia?
It was an article about how the Google founders and Jeff Bezos and, like, Julia Child, they're all Montessori grads. Actually, I didn't come up with the title for this piece. The editors of the Wall Street Journal did, but it just made this case that there's this whole posse of creative people that happen to be Montessori grads. So it was a well-titled article for viral, for virality. But, you would know about this better than me, Scott. Like, how can we get some of those mindsets and the growth mindset and, the nourishment of curiosity empowered from a younger age? That's a longer term project that I'd love to collaborate with you on with the Black Sheep Foundation.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, I'm deeply interested in the value of play and holding off and postponing the formal instruction, in kindergarten and preschool and even first grade, holding it off as long as possible, and having play and curiosity be the main drivers of youth. And then it lays the foundation. I mean, there's some really fascinating research coming out showing that when you do hold off, you find better learning outcomes on reading comprehension, for instance. There's this great study in New Zealand that found that to be the case when those who were in these environments where they're given more opportunity for discovery and play at a younger age. This stuff it's really important. It's not
super important. Yeah. No, it's life calling type important. Yeah.
What do you say? Life?
It's a life calling for me.
Oh, yes.
To help address this in education,
I would love to discuss potential collaborations. That'd be exciting. And so in not just play, but valuing and rewarding creativity is another big angle aspect of this. If you change the structures of an educational environment, so instead of like a report card where there's any such thing as failure, everything is, revisable. So I'm a big fan of making a revisable world, because that's
it. Yeah. I mean, and all the research we've seen from, again, Carol Dweck, deliberate practice would support that, So the world is screaming at us all saying parent differently and teach differently. And the systems are just very slow to change.
Yeah, they really are. And we're not, we're rewarding learning knowledge, which is okay to a certain degree, but there's hardly any reward for creating new knowledge. And
yes,
I'm returning back now in my head to an original thing you said in the beginning of this whole talk about predicting the future, invent the future, and when you invent the future, then you have a whole bunch of other people trying to predict the implications of it, but let them be like maybe a whole bunch of white sheep are predicting the implications, but be the black sheep who invents it.
Create a safe place for people to be human from the early stages of their life, and as much as possible, support them to find their, find their
self,
their calling. Yeah, find them. I always thought that when we were doing the research on True North, we got into the histories of all these 125 people we interviewed. And there were some people who came out of high school with a pretty high degree of self-awareness.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. That person from a young age had a high degree of self-awareness, and that helped them in everything they did in life. And I thought, God, when I came out of high school, I had no self-awareness, very little. And so, we need to create everything from safe spaces to cultures to systems that help, nourish that human potential. I think everything you're doing, Scott, is pulling the ore in that direction. And so from a research standpoint, there's just now a huge movement that I think is inevitably trickling over into educators, policymakers, business leaders. And it's maybe our job to try to help amplify that.
Yeah. I think that's a worthy job. That's great.
Yeah. It takes team effort.
Basil, do you want to have any? Do you have any questions? This is your unique opportunity for you to ask Peter anything that is on your mind.
Yeah, sure.
By the way, we're bringing in one of my students here on the podcast. First time I've ever done this on my podcast, where I've had another voice here. This is Basil Jackson.
Yeah. So, I guess one of the questions going through your book, you know, this might be kind of out there, but I noticed you look at different types of, I guess, creativity. But I'm wondering, you know, is there any way that you think that you can compare, you know, a group or an individual's creativity to that of another person's? You know, is there any way to rank creativity? Or, you know, do you believe that it is possible if, you know, or it is really, there's no measure of, you know, objective measure of someone's creativity versus another group's?
Boy, that's a good question. I think, yes, it's possible for sure, because as individuals, we all say, oh, that's creative, and that's coming from some definition of creativity. And, you know, it's my definition is you're putting new ideas together in a way that's fresh. I mean, for example, I just got an email right before this call from my co-founder of Silicon Guild, Ori Brofman, who's just a font of ideas, and he's got a batting average of about 200, we joke. But you know, he comes up with a couple great ideas every time. And it's like he sent this thing, Silicon Guild is by the authors for the readers. And I thought, you know, God damn it, that is so good. That is a fresh new idea. And who knows if it'll end up making it onto our website, but it could just be our tagline for a very long time. That's creativity. The psychologists, you know, the researchers have their ways of measuring creativity, and you know, I think, you know, it takes into account generativity and, you know, number of ideas that, you know, kind of consider, number of problems you consider. We know that you have to come up with a lot of possibilities before you even know what problems to be solved. You have to do the problem finding before you can do the problem solving. And so by definition, you know, you have to, you know, try a lot of routes because you're in new territory before you hone in on one. So I'd say I'm pretty in favor of that definition of measuring creativity as well, now that you ask.
And I guess leading off of that, just in your opinion, you know, you're an entrepreneur. Would you say in any specific industry, is it harder or easier to, you know, let that creativity flourish throughout that industry in terms of, you know, with starting a new business or even enhancing a business or, you know, a product or an offering?
Now, that's a great question, and I think the answer to that is 100% yes. There are certain creative industries where people who, you know, like this, you know, the process of generating ideas and developing ideas go. So it used to be the advertising world. Now that world is kind of melting down. So those types of people tend to, you know, gravitate more towards product roles where they can use the product development ideas from design in their job, or they go to, you know, of course we think of music and, you know, the storytellers of the world, whether they're movie makers or writers or what have you, they're storytellers. And on the other hand, you have industries where people are doing, you know, I have a friend from business school who runs a business that does HR management. And it's like, you know, there's just, it's not a creative, it's not a place where there's a lot of, yeah, you know, it's just.
Fair enough.
He's pretty creative, but there's just not a lot of creative.
Not a lot of opportunities.
Now, that said, the places where some of the most creativity is needed, where, you know, black sheep are kind of needed the most, is to go into places like, you know, large financial associations and help people rethink their mindset for the way they go about their job, because they're terrified of failure, and that's like the biggest challenge. They want to get out of that mindset because it's inhibiting them from doing their jobs well. So
that sounds good. Well, thanks a lot, Peter. We really appreciate this chat and the really incredible work that you're doing for you're really truly changing the world. So thank you.
No, man, you are. It's an honor to be with you guys. And thank you for having me. I'm sorry I have a muffled voice, but I really enjoyed it, and I can't wait to follow the series. So thanks for all you're doing.
Go Black Sheep.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as informative and thought-provoking as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com.